This morning, we want to take a special phase of communication, which is resolving conflict. And in all of my 43 years and 16 years of being married, I have only once met a couple or a man who said, "My wife and I have never had any conflict." I don't know what his testimony is the past 11 years. He told me that when he had been married 5. And in fact, Jerry and I, we had been married just about the same length of time as this couple. They were very dear friends of ours. But we hadn't seen them much in the 5 years either of us had been married. So he came through our area one night, and Jerry and I were sitting in the restaurant talking with him. And something came up about marital conflict, and he made the comment. He said, "In the 5 years we've been married, we've never had an argument, never had a disagreement." He said, and he wasn't sharing that braggingly, he just said, "We've just never had any conflict." What's that? Well, Jerry and I just sort of sat there silently. And on the way home, there was just this death pall on the car. I opened the front door and locked it. She darted through the door up the stairs ahead of me. I closed the door, locked it, kind of made sure the house was secure. I went into the bedroom and she broke into tears and sobbed. She says, "I feel so sinful." I said, "Honey, so do I." And we began to discuss it. She said, "But sweetheart, we're so different. You and I come from such different backgrounds. We have such different fringe values. At the center, our values were the same. Jesus Christ, Lordship, you know, evangelism, world conquest for Christ. You know, the basics we all agreed on. But whether we dusted the top of the fridge once a week or once a month or, you know, that sort of thing was different values. And whether I kept the tool kit, you know, just very neat, there's a little different values there." And she and I were talking and said, "You know, we've had so many adjustments, and here this couple has hardly had any." And so she was there crying, and as soon as I could get her under control, I said, "Well, sweetheart, now let's look at this a moment. Let's keep this in perspective." I says, "Now, let's remember that out of all the thousands of people we've ever met, this is only one couple who said this. So this isn't the norm. This is abnormal." And I said, "Secondly, we only talk to the husband. We haven't talked to the wife." I was grabbing at any kind of straw to encourage us. And you know, I do know that this couple has so many things in common, and they are very mature in many ways. And I don't doubt his integrity. I think that it probably was true. But you know, the interesting thing is that his lack of failure was not an encouragement to us; it was a discouragement. And I don't know why that is. Why it is that? Well, Paul says, "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man." And you see, we have the wrong view of conflict. Conflict, just for the sake of definition, I would like to draw a difference between conflicts and problems. I like to define a problem as an unresolved conflict. Conflicts can be developmental. They're healthy if they're handled properly. And it's very abnormal. And as our brother back here said, it's really a dull marriage if you don't have any conflict. Because a baby comes into the world, and the moment he arrives, the little one starts struggling. It's a conflict with disease, with germs. He builds up immunities. And if a baby came into the world and lived in a germ-free atmosphere for 4 or 5 years and then all of a sudden was subjected to our atmosphere, he'd probably succumb and die because he's had no conflict with germs. We have a conflict with sin. Paul says we wrestle not against flesh and blood. And there is no relationship on earth that can bring the scum to the surface of a person's life faster than marriage. If there is any sin, any scum, any selfishness in our lives, it'll come to the surface when we're married. And someone once said, if you want to know what kind of Christian a man is, ask his wife. I extend that and say, ask his kids. Or if you want to know what kind of Christian a woman is, ask her husband. See, there's no one in the world who knows me like Jerry does. And Jerry knows my strengths. She knows my weaknesses. But, you know, this morning, I can honestly say there's never been a time in my life when I loved her more than I love her this morning. But boy, we've had tears. And we've had disagreements. And we've had conflicts. But we've had to work our way through them. And sometimes it's taken days. And sometimes a long period of time. Sometimes they work out quickly. But these, I used to think that God gave marriage for procreation and for joy. But now, after being married 16 years, I'm sure there's another reason, and that is for training. Because there is no one on the face of the earth that has had a greater influence in my life to help me grow in my Christian life as has my wife. Because I have to face reality with her. I can't fool her. See, I can come here and talk a good talk to you, but she knows what I'm really like. As Howie Hendricks says, if it doesn't work at home, don't export it. That's why he said, if a man knows not how to rule his own house, how can he take care of the church of God? If you can't function in a small circle, Paul says, don't enlarge it. So the place for us to begin to allow ourselves to be vulnerable, to be exposed, to let sin come to the surface, have to say, I was wrong, please forgive me, and confess sin, get on our knees together and pray, there is where real training goes on in the Christian life. Now, we can either face those conflicts or we can sweep them under the rug. Like one wife told me in our home, when there was conflict, everyone just looked the other way. And for 3 or 4 days, they'd kind of look back to see if the dust had settled. And if it had, they'd all gather back around the table and just as though nothing had ever happened. Nothing was ever said. But you see, that's unhealthy. They pretend like it's all because emotions have subsided. They think the problem's solved, and it has not. There are guidelines in the scriptures for how to deal with conflict, and time may cause the emotion to subside, or separation may make us think there's no problem, but oh, it's under there. And the problem is that if we don't solve it, if conflicts are swept under the rug, they become a problem, just like a festering sore or a cancer. And the pressure, like a volcano, will build up under there. And these different little things that have been covered over, and all of a sudden one day, she or he will say something that demands about the energy of a spark plug, and it'll get a volcanic reaction. Have you ever reacted to your mate and then later thought, well, good night, why did I put so much horsepower behind that? I mean, it really was not that big a deal. Well, no, it wasn't that deal. It was the unresolved conflicts that you had swept under. I had swept under the rug and thought they were solved, but all of a sudden the pressure of all those came out through that one. So we can have better marriages, better communication, if we keep short accounts with our mates, keep our conflicts resolved, no matter how long it may take. So what are the biblical principles for resolving conflict? Now let's just sort of brainstorm here a minute. What are the types of conflicts that come up in marriage? Let's just take some examples, sort of the general ones that come up. What are they?
Money.
All right, how to spend money. Okay, what else?
Child discipline.
In-laws. What else? What was that? What church to go to, yeah.
Scheduling.
What's that?
Scheduling.
Scheduling. Yeah, egotism. She says something that makes me look small, and boy, that really bothers me, doesn't it?
Priorities.
All right, conflicts over priorities. What else?
Sexual adjustment.
Yeah, oh man, that. Some counselors say that the two biggest problems in marriage is sex and money. And couples begin to play little games. The husband says, okay, I control the finances. And the wife says, I control the sex. And so it becomes a little game of rewards and punishments. And boy, the conflicts that come up over sex and money. Okay, what else? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a very dangerous game. Someone says that it's almost legalized prostitution. That it's, I give you money. In fact, I know a man this morning. His heart is very, very heavy this morning. But he took his mother, his widowed mother's inheritance, supposedly to invest it for so she would have an income. But because he so desperately needed his wife's affection, which she was withholding from him, he just completely dissipated all of his mother's income, trying to buy his wife's affection. See, boy, and the man today would say, oh, I was wrong. But he was blinded because he so desperately was in need of affection that he tried to buy it. And many a woman today has given her body desperately trying to get love, but she sells or gives her body away, sex for love. So these are, yeah, it's not right, but it's games that couples play. And conflict comes up over how are we going to spend the money? What's the money for? And whose body is my body? Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 that when I get married, my body doesn't belong to me any longer. It belongs to my wife. And if I withhold it from her, I'm defrauding her. So those are conflicts. What are some others? Relationships? Yeah. You see, there's all kinds of things. Now, when there's a conflict, what is usually the real problem? Let's just take child discipline. Yeah, somebody's threatened, aren't they? See, sometimes I've had my wife say or do something, or fail to say something, or fail to do something. See, it can be either positive or negative, that threatened me, that made me angry. Have you ever stopped and asked yourself, you're about to say something, and then you say, but why does this bother me so much? What's the real issue? And that brings me to the first thing that I think we need to do. Let's say that today you have a conflict. You got up this morning and you went over to breakfast and you just sort of talked to the man over here and you just kind of turned your shoulder to your wife and she just kind of answered you with little clip answers. You know, you've got, you know, that kind of that little cool, that little one day mad that you've got. Okay, let's say we've got a conflict now with our mate. What is the first step to solving that? I know it's got to be solved. If I sweep it under the rug, it'll become a problem. So how do I deal with it? The first step starts with self-examination. I have to ask myself, okay, she's got a problem. She said something irresponsibly. She said something that hurt me. Or she failed to do something I asked, and that threatens my leadership and my ego. But Jim, why does that eat on you so much? And Jesus gave this principle in Matthew 7. Your brother's got a problem. Your wife, your husband's got a problem. And you see it. Oh, man, it is so clear that they're wrong. You could preach a sermon for 2 hours to her or him as to what's wrong with him or her. But Jesus said, why do you look at the speck in your mate's eye? Let's put mate in there instead of brother. Why do you look at the speck in your mate's eye but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your mate, let me take the speck out of your eye and behold the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite. If I try to solve my wife's problem when I'm upset, I am a hypocrite. That's what he said. I'm a hypocrite. He says, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly enough to take the speck out of your mate's eye. And we'll come back in a few moments to this thought about taking the speck. Clearly, you'll see clearly how to take the speck out of your mate's eye. I want to come back to that in a few moments because it's a separate principle. But the first principle is that when I'm upset and I'm bothered, The first thing to do is to get alone with God and search my own heart as to what my sins are. Okay, she said this, she's done this, but what is it that really is the problem? My pride, my ego? I'm selfish, I want to be Mr. Big, I want to be the king in my home. And boy, she's made me feel like the servant. So Jesus just said, stop and get the beam out of your own eye. I think this is why Jesus, or Paul said in Galatians 6:1, he said, if you see your brother overtaken in a fault. Now, who's going to go and talk to the brother who's overtaken in a fault? Paul says, you that are spiritual. Now, what does it mean to be spiritual? It means to be under the control of the Holy Spirit. Now, if I speak to Jerry when I'm not under the control of the Holy Spirit, what is going to happen? See, it's just back and forth with words or feelings or silent treatment. One of you shared yesterday Proverbs 12:18. There is the man that speaks like the piercing of a sword, but the tongue of the wise is health. See, if you've got a disease, there's two ways to open you up, with a sword or with a scalpel. One you live, one you die. And if I'm really concerned, if I really love you and I'm concerned that you live, I'll open you with a scalpel, not with a sword. So therefore, you know, if I've been in for major surgery before, and boy, when that old boy, I didn't watch him, but I used to scrub up with a doctor in my hometown when I was a kid in high school in surgery. And boy, I know that when I have some guy cutting on me, I don't want him, you know, doing like this. I want really a deft hand. I want him to know exactly. Don't make it too long. Just long enough, Doc, that just enough to get the problem taken care of. But I don't want him to come into that operating room inebriated or letting some novice. I'm sure the people being operated on in that little operating room down in Hollis, Oklahoma, would not have appreciated Robert Strigley saying, Jim, why don't you cut on her? You know, well, man, I had no training. I just take that scalpel and open up. But you see, Paul says, you that are spiritual, you're under the control of the Holy Spirit, and it's the Spirit now that's going to speak to the other person. And he says, you that are spiritual, restore such an one with a spirit of meekness, so that any time I'm going to solve somebody else's problem, I've got two things. I've got to be under the control of the Holy Spirit, and I've got to have an attitude of meekness, which means that I'm not a fighter. But the flesh is under control when I'm angry, and I'm also not in a spirit of humility and meekness. I want to get at that person. They've hurt me, so I want to hurt them. Well, see, that's wrong. So the purpose of self-examination is to confess my own sin, my own bad attitudes, my own wounded pride. Then the second step is, though, to be willing to confront. Be willing to confront. Now, when conflicts come up in marriage, let's take the general principles of how we deal with them. What are some of the maybe unhealthy ways that couples deal with conflict? Yeah.
You withdraw.
Yeah, silent treatment. Withdraw. What else?
You speak, but not in love. Tell the truth, but you don't.
Just lamb blast them. I call that the bulldozer effect. Yeah, just bulldoze right through. Okay?
You go up on tangents. You don't face the problem. You get out of serious.
Okay. Throw up a smoke screen.
You don't have a plan for it.
Yeah, just sort of shooting wild. See, well, all of those, you see what happens is that if you fight fire with fire like that, it just makes the problem worse. But Jesus gave us some... Jesus and Paul have given us some definite principles. I must be willing to go. Now, over here, the lady mentioned that we withdraw. See, some couples come from a home where boy, whatever, peace at any price, don't ever say anything to anybody. This lady I mentioned earlier, she said we'd look the other way and never discuss the problem. Well, Jesus doesn't give us that option because in Matthew 5, he says in verses 23 and 24, if therefore you are in church and you're presenting your offering, the offering plate comes by, and there you remember that your mate has something against you, don't put the offering in, leave it first, and first go and be reconciled to your mate, and then come and present your offering. Now, you know, if this is saying what I think it says, it means that if I've got an unresolved conflict with my mate and I go down in the morning to have my quiet time, boy, I may be thinking I'm having a quiet time, but God's face is against them that do evil, it says, and God's ear is not listening to me. He's not speaking to me by His Spirit. And so Paul or Jesus is saying here that if you know of somebody who has a problem with you, he says, before you offer your offering, before you go out in evangelism, before you do man-to-man with someone, before you do your Bible study or your quiet time, he says, make a beeline to get that put right. In other words, the principle is this, that reconciliation is more important or takes priority over worship. God doesn't want us worshiping Him if we're not right with someone. And so He says, leave your offering, go make it right, and then come back and give your offering. Now, this is Matthew 5. Look in Matthew 18. Here Jesus says, and if your mate sins, go and reprove your mate in private. And if he listens to you, you have won your mate, your brother. Now, what's the difference? What's the contrast between this verse and the one we read back in Matthew 5? What are the different conditions? Okay, in the Matthew 5, you sinned against your brother. In Matthew 18, your brother sinned against you. Now, in both cases, what are you supposed to do? Have you ever thought, well, boy, she hurt me, and I'll forgive her if she'll come and apologize. Have you ever had that feeling? Well, she has hurt me. She said something that's hurt me, and so therefore I'll just wait till she crawls to me and ask for forgiveness. And then I'll forgive her. Well, see, Jesus doesn't leave us that option. Jesus said, whether you are the offender or the offended, go get that put right. Then when you combine that with the first principle, it means the first thing I do, though, is search my own heart, make sure I'm in the Spirit and I have a spirit of meekness. Then I'm willing to go, whether I am the offender or the offended, and say, come now and let us reason together. Could we talk this over? And the purpose of self-examination also is to let the emotional energy get out of, calm down. You know, the world says it this way, when you're angry, count to 10. Jesus says, when you're angry, go get the log out of your eye. And I have found that if I'm upset with somebody, if I can just stop long enough to say, now, God, they may have a problem, but do I have any problems? Yeah, Lord, I'm angry right now. I just kind of like to see that person get a raw deal. I just, you know, and Lord, that's not love. God, that's sin. And somehow when I get down at the foot of the cross and have to confess my sins, I can get up then and deal in a spirit of patience with another person who's sinned. But I must be willing to go. And we have this, you know, someone has said that for every truth in the Christian life, you have a flannel graph of it. You have a drama of it in the Old Testament. And the drama of this principle in the Old Testament is in Genesis 13, when Abraham and Lot's flocks were so big they could no longer have their herds together. And the herdsmen were beginning to fight out in the field. And in Genesis 13, verse 8, do you remember what Abraham did? Yeah, and he was the one who initiated the confrontation. It was the more mature one that took the first step. One husband and wife came to counseling with this conflict and said, well, the husband says, well, man, in every conflict, I'm always the one that has to initiate the confrontation. I said, well, haven't you been a Christian longer and aren't you more mature? Abraham was the more mature, and it says he went to Lot and said, Lot, let there be no strife between me and thee and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we're brothers. See, Abraham loved Lot so much that he took the first step to be reconciled. So, principle number one, start with self-examination. Principle number two, be willing to quickly get this issue resolved, if possible. And by if possible, I mean if possible to do it quickly. Now, the third principle. Okay, here we sit, eyeball to eyeball. I've gone and said, honey, could we talk it over? Now, the third principle is speak the truth in love. Ephesians 4:15, Paul says, but speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in all aspects into Him who is the head, even Christ. And I don't know of anything that stifles spiritual growth more than a relationship of husband and wife where we're not speaking the truth and love to each other. We can't grow. It stifles spiritual growth. But there's two things here. Speak the truth and then speak it in love. And speak in loving patience and admitting my own mistakes. Try this sometime. If you have a conflict and you're going to bring your mate's problem to her attention or to his attention, start out by saying, now, honey, I'm going to mention something, but I first of all want to confess that my attitude has not been right in this either. You probably noticed I've been giving you the silent treatment for the last 2 days, and that's sin, and I ask your forgiveness. Boy, that's a terrific way to start out a confrontation to tell somebody else their problem, is to get your own all dealt with. But then to speak the truth, telling the other person what they did that hurt you and how that made you feel. In other words, I was crushed. This happened in our own home a week ago. Jerry, we had an ice cream maker, one of these electric ones, and it says that when it begins to sort of grind down, immediately pull the plug out because you can ruin the motor. Well, I didn't realize that in the 3 years we'd had that ice cream maker, I had always made the ice cream. Jerry had never made it. I read the instruction booklet and everything. Well, on this particular Saturday, this was week before last, she made the ice cream because I was busy out in the yard with the yard work, and she didn't know that about it. She thought it just would stop. So I came in and I said, is the ice cream ready yet? And she says, yeah. She said, I went downstairs a while ago and the machine had already stopped. I said, well, you unplugged it, didn't you? Oh, no, I just left it. I said, oh, honey, that ruins the motor. She says, oh, I didn't know that. So I went downstairs and I was really ticked. I pull that thing out and right there written on the top was, if it grinds, you know, stop it. See, and so I went up to the kitchen and we had a fella helping us that day in the yard. And so I did not realize he had come in the house, and I was standing in the kitchen and I came in, I was trying to be patient. I said, sweetheart, honey, look, it says it right here. Oh, she says, I'm sorry. So I laid it down and I did a few more things around the kitchen. The guy came in, I didn't see him standing back there. And I walked back over and I picked it up again. I said, oh, no. And she saw him back there. And she just left the kitchen, went up into the bedroom, broke into tears. And I thought, oh, what's happened? And I went up And she said, "Well, Jim, honey, why did you have to say it three times?" She says, "I was crushed that I ruined that, but you just kept rubbing it in." And I said, "Sweetheart, I was wrong. I did not mean to even imply that with someone else there. I don't want us dragging our little disagreements or conflicts out in front of other people. So I did not know he was even standing there. But I said, the fact that I brought it up the second and third time was wrong. It was sin on my part, and I ask your forgiveness." Well, we got it all tidied up, and she dried her eyes, and we went back down and had a wonderful time with supper. It was good ice cream. It really was. It was frozen very well. But you know, what happened there was that I really didn't mean, I honestly don't think I, no, I may have. Yeah, I may have meant to say, "Would you read the instructions better?" But you know, the fact that I said it this time and I said it this way, and each time she had said, "I'm sorry," she was saying, "It crushed me that you said it three times and then said it with that guy standing there." So I said, "Well, honey, that's wrong." Well, she was speaking in love to me. She didn't raise her voice. She just told me, "You brought it up three times and it just made me feel stupid." So it became an occasion for repentance to me, and I learned something. But see, these little things, I don't know how it is in your marriage, but just ever so often a little something like this comes up, and we need to deal with it by being willing to confront and then speak the truth in love. The pattern that I grew up in, a home where there was a lot of order. I mean, we always had a reason for doing everything. I ran my life by my watch. I can never remember a time in my life ever being late to church. I mean, we were like robots. In our home, I was very rigid. And one of the biggest problems that Jerry and I ran into in our marriage was that Jerry just loves living. She just enjoys people, you know, and I don't think she looks at her watch very often. For 2 years, this was a real point of conflict with us until we visited her home 2 years after we were married. And Mom Davis came in one night and she says, "Well, it's time for supper." So she said, "Well, let's have some supper." So she went in and she says, "Oh, there's no food." "Well, go get some." So I said, "Well, I'll take you down to the food market, you know." And so we went down, we got some food, and this was at 5:30. At 7:30, we finally wound up eating. The next night, we ate at 5:30. The next night, 6:30, you know. And I thought, "Oh, that's where it comes from." That's where it comes from. But you know, Jerry, her family was so tight-knit that they just enjoyed each other. They were not robots. They just enjoyed living. Their whole family was just a tight-knit unit. In fact, to this day, if Jerry and I want to have a beautiful vacation, just totally relaxed, we go to my in-laws. We go to Mom and Dad Davis's. They just kind of, they just make us feel like a king and a queen. You sleep, get up whenever you want to, do whatever you want, sit and read. There's no demands. And we just have a great vacation. But, you know, if you're working with people, though, you've got to have somewhat of a schedule, you know, if you're dealing with people outside and whatnot. So Jerry feels that she's learned to be more organized and look at her watch more. She tells me that I've learned to relax a little bit. But, you know, this has been one of the big areas of conflict with us. It's just been over time. And I think, though, that in our early marriage, because her values on certain things, like time, were not mine, I almost equated that with sin. And, you know, if she wasn't on time for something, I'd say, honey, sweetheart, we got to be there. We're late. I've got to lead that meeting. Oh, okay. So take off, you know. But, you know, she told me one time, she said, "Jim, when you get irritated with me," she said, "it just crushes me." And I thought to myself, well, you know, if people are irritated with me, it crushes me too. I don't like people to be irritated with me. So maybe I better not be that way with her. And we'd been married several years, and one night she did something. I don't remember what it is now, I've even forgotten the issue. But I, instead of mentioning it to her right away, I thought, now let me try these principles. So I went away and I said, now why does this bother me so much? And really it was simply because I thought she hadn't listened to me when I said, we'll leave at 7:30. And I thought, okay, God, that's just pride on my part, because if I'm the king, I want everyone listening and bowing and scraping, and God, that's not right. So I got my heart right, and then I thought, what is the real problem? So for a couple of days, I just thought through on it, and I wrote down a few suggestions as to what I thought the real issue was and how we might correct that next time. So I was laying in bed two nights later, and she came over. I was leaving on a trip the next day, real early in the morning, and she just leaned over and gave me a little kiss on the cheek, and she was just real warm and affectionate, and I said, sweetheart, I love you. She said, I love you. I said, could I talk to you, though, for a minute? She backed off. She said, what's the matter? I said, it's okay. It's all right. I said, just a little something that happened a couple of days ago, and I thought I'd just talk to you about it. Okay. So I started, you know, just calmly telling her the problem. At one point, she says, do you mind if I go around and lay down like you are? I said, no, fine. So she came around, she laid down, and then she looked over and says, continue. Boy, I never had that happen before. Usually when I'd say something in a spirit of irritation, she'd be irritated, you know, and we'd be... But this time she says, go on. So I finished, and then tears started trickling down her cheeks, and she looked at me and she said, Jim, I don't want to be that way. I don't want to do that. She said, could I get up and get a pencil and paper and write those suggestions down? Those are good suggestions. And she said, then would you pray with me about it? And so she wrote it down. She says, now, is this what you're actually saying, that if I do this and this, that we'd solve that problem? Well, honey, I prayed about it, and as best I know, that seems to be the solution. Oh, that looks like a good idea, she said. And so we got on our knees and prayed about it. And afterwards I thought, Jim White, how stupid. Why don't you do that all the time? I mean, if the objective is to get another person to change in something, why not do it the wisest way? And Jesus tells us how to do it. First of all, examine my own heart. Then secondly, choose the right time to go and make an issue of it, but then speak the truth in love. So the other person does not feel you have rejected them, but maybe just their behavior or whatever it was about them. Suzanne Wesley used to spank her children, but she'd always stay with them when she spanked them, and she'd pull them up on her lap while they cried, so that they would get it would be communicated to them, I have spanked you with that stick because I've rejected your behavior, but I love you. And as the warmth of her body was next to that child, it was communicated, it's not you I'm rejecting. But you see, when we correct our mates or speak to them in a spirit of irritation, it communicates rejection to them personally. So Paul says, speak the truth in love. Now I think principle number four, and this is the last one, is always assume personal responsibility. You know, I think the thing that made David a man after God's own heart was when Nathan came to him, told him the little story and said what should happen. And David said, oh, the man should have to pay for it. And Nathan said, thou art the man. And immediately David said, I have sinned. What is our natural inclination when someone comes and brings something to our attention in a way that they say we have offended them? What is our natural inclination? Self-defense. Yeah, defend ourselves. Well, but see, you don't understand. Really, what I meant was this. Or we can even say, well, you're bringing my problem, but look at your problem. See, in defending ourselves. But A.W. Tozier, in his little booklet entitled Five Vows for Spiritual Power, one of those vows is never defend yourself. Ecclesiastes 4:13 says, better is a poor and a wise child than an old and foolish king who will no more be admonished. And I think that the reason, you take Saul's sin and David's sin, and really David's was more hideous. If we were to have a little court this morning and we were judging Saul and David, which is the worst? If God tells us to kill all the sheep and all the people and we save the king and save some of the sheep, and it's even a better case if we can say we save the sheep in order to sacrifice to God. And then we could even have humanitarian groups today coming to our rescue if we save the life of somebody. But God had said, put him to death. David, on the other hand, over here, took another man's wife and committed adultery. And then he tried to cover up by having the guy murdered and looked like he was home and dry. But you know, as we look back in the scriptures, which man was more favorable in God's eyes?
David.
Because when Samuel came and put his finger on Saul's sin, Saul said, well, it was the people who made me do it. See, if Saul at that point had just said, oh, I have sinned. God forgive me. Saul could have gone on and been great. David had a much more hideous sin, and when the finger was put on him, he said, I have sinned. And I believe that we could resolve conflict in our marriages if we would not be defensive. Make excuses, try to explain it away, try to run, hide behind bushes. But if our mate comes and says, boy, you really hurt me by this. And we say, sweetheart, boy, I was wrong. Forgive me. So assume personal responsibility. Okay, any questions on those before we take a second inventory this morning on the screen? Any on those particular principles? Any question or comment you'd like to make for clarification? Yes?
I have a question, like when you say something, your wife lets you know that she's hurt, she runs off with pride. That seems to be a little signal. Is it good for us to have a signal maybe for us to cry for a man to somehow signal one another that we've been offended? Or should she be able to say to you, you really hurt my feelings? I don't know. What's the difference?
Well, I think we have to accept who we are, and women and some men are just emotional. And when you're hurt, you just need to let that release go. I think in Jerry's case of the situation I shared with you 2 weeks ago, she just didn't want to make a scene in front of the guy. She didn't even cry in front of him. She just kind of walked out softly, and when I got up to the bedroom, she was in tears. So I think that it's a good thing for us to not... there have been times when Jerry and I, maybe even at the table, would have a... I could see we disagreed on something, and the kids would be sitting around. And I'd say, sweetheart, I can see that maybe we don't see eye to eye on that. Why don't we go up to the bedroom after dinner and talk that over? So I think to not resolve our conflicts in front of other people is a good principle. But, these little signals. If you feel like crying, cry. Most of us men in the beginning of marriage don't know how to deal with a woman who's crying. But you learn how after a few years. Yeah.
This woman will probably feel less like crying, and she'll be less likely to burst into tears and sob and whatnot if she would say, you hurt my feelings, when she doesn't have this need to cry.
Yeah, if there's the opportunity to do that, sort of depends on the heaviness of the hurt as to how quickly they cry. Yes.
It also depends on the mood the woman's in. As a husband, you know that we are creatures of many myriad unexplainable moods.
Tell me more.
Anyway, you know what I'm saying. Sometimes it'll hit us, and the tears will jump unbidden and unwanted.
Uh-huh.
Other times, the fire of anger. I know Lloyd can see it in my eyes, and it's liable to pop out. Now, look, you hurt me, and I don't want any more of that. Let's get this straightened out. But other times, it depends on my mood.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we have to do is, if we feel our mood is such that we could not speak the truth in love, that's when it's best just to wait. And I've had Jerry sometime to tell me, honey, I got something to say, but I'm just not ready to say it right now. Okay, well, we know, we have the little agreement, she is going to say it when she feels she can say it.
Like, Lord knows it's a signal when I say, I'm going to take a walk, and I don't have to.
Right, that should be a very good signal. I think I'd get that point, too. But see, if we know that our mate isn't going to sweep it under the rug, as soon as she gets her heart right or is ready, then she will tell me what it is that bothers her. And then part of that assuming responsibility is not only being willing to admit to our mate that we're wrong, but boy, to always end up taking each other in our arms and having a word of prayer together. Because we not only confess our sins to each other, but of course we've sinned against God, so together, it's humbling for a husband to have to say, "Dear Lord, I was inconsiderate of my wife." See, first,
sometimes when I start on that walk, I'm really irritated with
you. Sure you are.
I just don't understand why he can't see the line, why he can't correct it. But by the time I get back, it's, "Lord, I'm really sorry that I made such a mess of this whole mess."
Yeah, you see your part in it by that time. Right, yes.
What about when you take the responsibility and you confront it, and the response you get is they're still denying maybe what they've done, or they won't confront it? You just drop it, or what?
Time out? Yeah. Okay, yeah.
That piece right there, I think I'm going to kind of ask the same question. They know it's wrong, you go for forgiveness and error, people won't talk to you, they won't admit to it. I think you feel if you do all you can and back off, and then the Spirit of God will convict them. They see you're in like a nice mood, you're trying to carry on things, and looking at it and realize they're wrong. It's worked for me too, and I see my wife ask me for forgiveness, and I decided to be the problem, you know, and just stay away from that. I can do with it, and I just never realize.
Yeah. Right. Well, if your mate has offended you and you go and she doesn't take the responsibility or he doesn't take the responsibility but excuses himself, then probably to start the cycle all over is the best thing. In other words, to back off, wait a day or two to give God a chance to calm things down, to let them see themselves afresh. And then in a non-threatening atmosphere, sometime when kind of everybody's sort of, you know, having a good time, say, "Hey, could we talk about the other night?" But see, then you're more and more of a neutral atmosphere, and you have an opportunity to say, "Sweetheart, I really don't think we solved the problem. You just evaded it, and I still feel offended." I'm presuming here that both parties are believers and want to really please the Lord. If you've got a non-Christian husband or wife who really isn't interested in pleasing the Lord, then what you may have to do is be willing to forgive without a confession. See, forgiveness is all part of this too. The two problems I see that can come up most often is, I go to my mate who's offended me, and she excuses herself or defends herself. The other problem that comes up is, let's say that I go to my mate and I say, "Honey, I've blown it, please forgive me." And she says, "No." Or I won't do it. See, well, you can't make somebody forgive you. But oh, do the scriptures have some terrible repercussions to the person who won't forgive somebody who's asking to forgive. That's when, though, you just kind of back off. And I personally have never had that happen to me. I never asked someone's forgiveness that they refused to give it. But I understand there are some of those times. Yes?
Just having that servant heart and just to get brought out really helped me for the teacher, because I wasn't ministered to, and excuse myself.
Yeah. But see, you do have feelings. And yesterday I was going to mention this, and someone reminded me of it. We need to make sure we understand that feelings are neither right nor wrong. They just are. They are amoral. Now, attitudes can be right or wrong. And if those feelings are not dealt with properly, they can become bad attitudes, which are wrong. But see, if you go to your husband and say, you know, dear, I just, somehow the fact that every night I cook all the meals and then you go in and prop your feet up and read the paper while I do all the dishes again, and this has gone on month after month, I realize that it's a bit, you know, it may seem selfish on my part, and I probably am feeling sorry for myself, but honestly, I just don't really feel like you care or appreciate what I'm doing. Now, see, if something's said like that, I think that's very legitimate. Because those feelings, they're being said responsibly and honestly, and we are human beings. And we need to let our mates know how we feel. If they're being inconsiderate, if you're oversensitive, you might say, oh, I'm just feeling sorry for myself. But you repress that, you put that feeling down and deny it's there, and it can someday become a bad attitude and something else. So I think those feelings need to be expressed in an honest way and in a responsible way. Yeah?
I have two things. Do you think it's mostly pride that makes us be self-defensive to our mates?
Yeah, insecure. Insecure. You know, we all, somehow back as children, depending on how our parents disciplined us or what their attitude was toward our disobedience, we may have learned that, boy, the worst thing in the world that can happen is to be caught doing something wrong. And in fact, I asked a fellow just the other day, he was almost destroying his life by, I think, trying to be something that he wasn't. And I said to him, have you ever considered failure? Would you be willing to fail? Fail? No. No, sir. No, I won't fail. I said, but you know, did you ever realize that failure may be a stepping stone to maturity? You know, failure need not be final. Every man or woman of God that God has ever used had to experience failures, because failure builds humility into you. So I said, if you're trying to ensure your life that you never fail, you may kill yourself trying. But you've got to be vulnerable and risk failure. And I think sometimes defensiveness is I just don't want to fail in anybody's eyes. I want to always look good. It's pride. It's insecurity. It's a false concept of failure. Because when you and I have failed and we say, God, I have failed, or we say to our mate, I've blown it, there is an immediate liberation that comes into you. I had a wife tell me the other day that for years, up in the double number of figures, every time her husband brought something to her attention, she always gave a defense. She'd always tell why she was right. And one day, she had the grace of God. He walked in and said, hey, why is that kid not making his bed? And instead of defending herself, she went and got her heart right. She came to her husband and she said, honey, I have really blown it. I should have been training that child to make his bed more consistently. Will you forgive me for dropping the ball on that? And she told me a liberation swept into her heart when she did that. She said, the moment I took the responsibility for something that was my responsibility and admitted I failed, no excuses, no defense, she said, immediately I had an emotion I never had before in my life. I think that's true. Failure is the stepping stone to the grace of God. See, we can't have grace from God if we're not failures. Grace is for failure. Yes. Okay. Well, in a veteran? Okay. Terrific.
Searching the years together and all the theories that were brought up, it didn't work. Nothing worked. Because we have two different characters. They're so wide apart that it's probably impossible to find two equal the same as we are as far as character is concerned. You're about 180 degrees apart.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't always work the way that the book says. On top of that, for most of our time, I had not been a Christian and my wife was. So that's another thing. We found a solution. Following, my wife has always adhered to what's written in Ephesians 5, verse 21, that says, your wives must submit to your husband's leadership in the same way you submit to the Lord. And I know that in the United States, with all that woman led movement, this doesn't fall very good. I tried to keep her through that world at this time, although I wasn't a Christian, because it was in my own favor. I said, you have to submit. But about 10 years ago, I got an idea one day. I said, look, if you take a ship, there's a captain on board. There's only one captain. But that ship could really sail very properly if you leave the hands of the first officer that knew the steering, and the first engineer that keeps the engine running. And if the first engineer would keep his engines, and the first officer would keep his steering, that ship would go out just as good as if there was a captain who would call it all the shots. Provided on the little details where the authority would overlap, they come together and just say, hey, what do we do? And we applied that. And we found out that the things where I was a total failure, my wife was an expert.
Yeah.
Thing for she's a total failure and I was an expert. So we divided things up in our partnership, whereby I take the decisions and call the shots on the things that she admits, and I'm better on what she is. And on the other side, where she's better, I just submit totally to her.
Uh-huh.
This might be a solution to those couples that have the same problem we have, that have characters that are so wide apart that through all these hoops, all the instructions, they can't find them.
Yes. Well, I really appreciate that testimony. You know, we look in Paul's admonition there to wives, adapt yourselves to your husbands, submit to them. But just a couple of verses before that, Paul had said, yea, all of you be subject and submit to one another. And there is a proper way and time for me to recognize that my mate can do something better than I can, and to allow them that freedom and liberty to do that, and to appreciate that and admire it in my mate. And, you know, Jesus Christ is the great adhesive. And when Christ, it's like a triangle. When two objects become close to the same object, they are of necessity close to each other. And that attitude of submission, the attitude of humility is, I think, the real secret to every marriage. Well, you remember yesterday we asked you to take an inventory focusing on your mate. And now this morning I want you to take one focusing on yourself. And I'd like to relate this to the very thought that our friend back here brought out a while ago about, well, I have these feelings and maybe I think these are my rights, but maybe I'm just being selfish. Well, you are a human being and there are certain things that you do want, and provided your attitude is right, you need to let your mate know that, what you need. And so, oh, someone, she says, this is what I've been waiting for. All right. Question number one, list three things you would like your spouse or your mate to do more often. My wife said to me one day, honey, I came in, threw my coat in the corner and got out and played with the kids in the living room for about 10 minutes, rolled and wrestled with him. And when I came in the kitchen, Jerry had tears in her eyes. And I said, honey, what's the matter? And she said, oh, I'm just so happy that you played with the kids. She said, boy, you know, I just wish you'd do that more often. Well, you know, I realized that I'd been neglecting that. So list three things you would like your spouse to do more often. Then secondly, list one thing that bugs you about your mate's behavior. But don't just put that down, but what practical suggestions do you have for the change? And then thirdly, how would you like your mate to make your mate to request changes in some of the things you do? In other words, how do you like to be corrected? One husband says if she'll just do it any time, but not at night, not the last thing before we go to bed. Or one wife says if he'll just say it in a calm voice. If he won't get uptight and get angry with me, then he can tell me anything. Okay, well, you describe for your mate how you like requests for changes to be made.